Hello, I'm Mark Steiner. Welcome back to the Mark Steiner Show here on WEAA. Remind you, support is provided for WEAA by Bosch, offering Bosch dishwashers at B-Ray and Scarf. We're about to tackle the issue of stand your ground laws. We're going to be doing a whole series of conversations and commentaries in the coming weeks as a result of the Zimmerman trial and hearing commentaries from writers, thinkers, and activists from across the country, what they think this says to us and where we go. One of those issues clearly is stand your ground. The law is now, I think, over 30 states that even though it was not legally part of the trial, it was part of the closing testimony and affected the trial. Of George Zimmerman and what these laws really mean. We have joining us here for this conversation, John Nichols, Washington correspondent for The Nation magazine, contributing writer for The Progressive and In These Times, associate editor of The Capital Times, the daily newspaper in Madison, Wisconsin, and co-author of Dollarocracy, How the Money and Media Election Complex is Destroying America. Reminding you all, on September 17th, he and Bob McChesney will be here with me in a live conversation. I don't want to miss that when they're both here. Horace Cooper joins us, a writer and legal commentator, research fellow at the National Center for Public Policy Research, senior fellow with the Heartland Institute, director of law and regulation at the Institute for Liberty. Horace, welcome back. Danielle Belton is with us. She's editor-at-large of Clutch Magazine Online, creator of the blog blacksnob.com. Danielle, good to have you with us. Jacob Sullum is with us. He is senior editor of Reason Magazine, Reason.com, national syndicated columnist whose column appears in the New York Post and the Chicago Sun-Times. And at some point during this conversation, we're going to have a caller from Dream Defenders who is fighting against Stand Your Ground in Florida and will be joining us for some commentary as well. So, folks, welcome. Good to have you all with us.
Thank you. Pleasure.
Thank you.
410-319-8888 is the number here. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. We want to hear your thoughts on Stand Your Ground. And John Nichols, let me go to, I just want to get a political perspective first from you and then from Horace Cooper, and then we'll open it up to everybody, about what the political significance is of the growth of Stand Your Ground and what it meant. John?
Sure. Well, the Stand Your Ground law is a fascinating piece of legislation, and it's a broad term for, it's become a broad term for a number of laws that have been passed over the last decade, essentially saying that a person who feels frightened, a person who feels that they may be threatened, does not have a responsibility to retreat from the circumstance they're in, does not have a responsibility to try and protect themselves. They can harm, even kill, the person they feel threatened by without fear of legal repercussions. And this is not a piece of legislation that Americans demanded. It isn't something that, you know, you saw people rising up across the country saying they wanted. It's a piece of legislation developed in Florida by a lobbyist for the National Rifle Association and a big advocate for the gun industry and for retailers that sell guns. And it was signed into law in 2005 in Florida, then taken national by the group, the American Legislative Exchange Council, ALEC, which is a group largely funded by corporations that works with a lot of state legislators around the country. And they went state by state. They passed variations on Stand Your Ground in roughly two dozen states. And the Stand Your Ground law kind of flew under radar for a long time. Along with some so-called castle doctrine laws, which were more, Stand Your Ground's kind of on the street, castle doctrine's more in your yard, whether you want to shoot somebody who you feel threatened by. But obviously the Trayvon Martin case made this a big deal, because after George Zimmerman shot Trayvon Martin, there was great confusion about whether to charge George Zimmerman, some concern that he couldn't be charged because of Florida's Stand Your Ground law. Finally, he was charged, and Zimmerman's defense chose not to mount a classic Stand Your Ground defense, rather to go with self-defense. And many people who are uninformed about the case and didn't follow it think that Stand Your Ground wasn't a part of it. In fact, Stand Your Ground wove through the whole case. It was discussed in testimony. There was actual questioning on the extent to which George Zimmerman had been trained with regard to Stand Your Ground, things like that. And in the jury instructions, there was reference to Stand Your Ground, very specific reference to it. And finally, the first juror to be interviewed about the case said that one of her justifications for believing that George Zimmerman could be let off was stand your ground. So it's actually deeply woven into this case, and it's become a flashpoint since then. There's been a great deal of effort, states across the country, to try and reverse these laws that people never asked for. They were sort of just, you know, slid into state law legislation around the country by ALEC and the NRA.
And Horace Cooper, before we jump on, I want to get to our other guests here because we have a 45-minute segment. I'll make sure everybody gets in here in this conversation. Your defense of the stand your ground laws, based
right.
on what?
Well, let's start with, let's clarify that a lot of folks paid attention based on the Trayvon Martin killing trial of George Zimmerman. However, what stand your ground did had little to no impact on the outcome of that trial or the incident that occurred. With or without a stand your ground law, the same exact trial could have taken place, likely would have taken place, and the same exact outcome would have taken place. Stand your ground laws are a reform of self-defense rules that got changed mostly in the 1920s, 30s, and 40s. One of the first cases involving self-defense was an 1877 case in which the Supreme Court dealt with the question of what right do individuals have to defend themselves. And in that case, there was no retreat requirement merely because you could leave. There was a requirement that you have a reasonable fear of loss of liberty or life, and that in that circumstance, you could use up to deadly force without having to retreat. What led to these stand your ground reforms were a series of changes that made it harder and harder for individuals to be able to exercise the rights to defend themselves. And in particular, black Americans post-slavery were victimized under these kinds of so-called reforms.
Well, let's bring it to the 21st century. I mean, to what these stand your ground laws mean now and why you think they're needed.
Well, I would argue, as the evidence has shown, more black Americans than any other group in the state of Florida have been able to defend themselves from hostile activities, and they are therefore left free from prosecutions that otherwise would have gone forward when, in fact, they were involved in unprovoked attacks by third parties. There has been a significant recognition across the country that police response times are insufficient, and people actually don't have the freedom to assume that as long as there is a police department somewhere nearby, all of their problems are going to be addressed. Self-help, which is a constitutional right, is the essence and genesis of these stand your ground laws, and they have the effect of allowing individuals who are unfairly being attacked not to have to run and instead to be able to respond to that assault if it is determined to be serious enough that they could be injured in some significant way or even lose their lives. These are very, very legitimate responses to the changing circumstances where we find ourselves with resources that aren't able to support the kind of law enforcement response that people might have counted on in the past.
Let me throw it. And Danielle, your article takes a very different position on this.
Yes. I was citing some statistics from a study that the Urban Institute had recently done that talked about how in stand your ground states versus non-stand your ground states, it was specifically about how race played a role in how sometimes these rulings went down. Now, they don't know exactly if it had to do with race because they can't quantify that, but in cases of states where stand your ground with the law, if it was a white person shooting a black person and claiming self-defense, they had a 354% chance of being having their homicide ruled as justified, whereas black people, whether they were shooting another black person or if they had happened to kill a white person claimed self-defense, had a negative chance of getting ruled that that the shooting was justifiable. So there's some unevenness at least apparent in the numbers that come from the State Department, that come from the DOJ, that kind of look at the statistics regarding Stand Your Ground and Stand Your Ground states. I personally don't feel the laws are necessary. I feel like they're an unnecessary extension of pre-existing self-defense laws that we have that do, I believe, that do work. I believe it encourages people to take the law into their own hands. And the reality is not everyone is going to assess danger in the same way. I was on a different show, and I was remarking about how I'm not very tall. I'm only 5'3", and I'm a female. And there are often times that I feel personally threatened because I find, if I'm walking alone in the city, I find many men to be intimidating. You know, based on just my perception of what is scary to me or who I think might attack me, can I just go around and use force against other people if they, if someone just grabs me or approaches me in the wrong way because I perceive the threat? I mean, I'm someone where I feel like I perceive threats a lot, quite a bit. And so it's like, what's the end game? What's the consequence of that if you have a law where all I can say is, you know, I was scared and I really thought that guy was going to hurt me when he grabbed my arm. Like, that guy could have been just grabbed my arm just trying to get my attention. And it's like, I have to make the assessment, you know, whether or not I'm going to use force in a situation, whether I'm going to pull out mace or whether I'm going to do anything. But it just seems... It seems too loose in its interpretation. It just seems like it gives too much leeway to where you could basically just shoot first and ask questions later.
So Sierra joins us here. She's a Dream Defender from Florida. Sierra, good to have you with us here. Tell me what you're doing in Florida now. Well, what is it you're opposing, and what's taking place in Miami in Florida right now, and Tallahassee?
Okay, thank you so much for having me on. Yes. The Dream Defenders are currently at the Capitol in Tallahassee, Florida. And, you know, what we're doing is calling on the governor to convene a special legislative session to review not only Stand Your Ground law, but also school to prison pipeline, which also played a part into the case with Trayvon Martin and George Zimmerman, and also racial profiling that is promoted within law enforcement. So, we've been at the Capitol for 13 days now, day and night, sleeping here, waiting, not passively, but waiting for the governor to take leadership in Florida and to call a special legislative session to review the issues that I've mentioned before.
So let me just throw this out. I'm sorry, Jacob, let me get your quick thoughts on here. Then I want to kind of throw out a really larger question to all of you all and have folks join us at 410-319-8888. Jacob?
Yeah, I wanted to clarify. It's not enough to feel vulnerable, to be afraid under the law. You have to have a reasonable fear of imminent death or serious injury, and you have to reasonably believe that that's what's going on. Not enough simply to be afraid. And I also wanted to clarify why the Stand Your Ground defense is not relevant in the Zimmerman case, because according to the scenario that he described, which apparently the jury accepted, he was knocked to the ground, he was pinned there, he was being pummeled, he was having his head knocked against the concrete. In that situation, there was no way for him to escape. There was no way for him to retreat. Therefore, the fact that there was no duty to retreat was not relevant. And although it's true that one of the jurors in an interview after the trial mentioned the Stand Your Ground law, it was also clear from what she said that she believed, and presumably other jurors as well believed, the basic outlines of the story. Maybe not every detail, but the idea that he was attacked by Martin, that Martin knocked him to the ground, and therefore that he had no way to escape. So that's why Stand Your Ground was not relevant there. In terms of the racial patterns in the use of the Stand Your Ground defense, in Florida, the Tampa Bay Times found that blacks and whites are about equally likely to use that defense successfully and to avoid prosecution when they have used a Stand Your Ground defense in self-defense cases. So there does not seem to be a pattern of racial discrimination when you look at defendants in Florida. And in terms of the delay of the arrest, it's true that that law in Florida, not every state has this, but the law in Florida has a provision that says the probable cause that you need to arrest someone applies not just to whether a homicide occurred, because clearly that had happened, but also to whether there was probable cause to believe that it was not in self-defense, right? So the police needed to show not just that Zimmerman had killed Martin, but that he had done so without justification. They needed probable cause to believe that. So that may very well have contributed to the delay in his arrest, but that is distinct from the stand your ground principle, which has to do with the duty to retreat when you're attacked in a public place.
But who's that trying to break in? Danielle, were you trying to say something? Was it Sierra?
Oh, it's actually Sierra. I basically just wanted to respond to this gentleman's comments, and with a couple of different things. You know, the first thing is that, you know, in response to the woman saying that sometimes it has to do with the perception of being in danger, and you're saying that that doesn't have any, you know, merit when it comes to using a stand your ground defense. However, and there's a case that the Dream Defenders, as well as the NAACP, they actually just delivered a letter to Governor Scott outlining this, is that now stand your ground is extending to where it's even being used in schools with a young man in South Florida who recently beat a woman or a young lady there in high school on a bus and is using self-defense, stand your ground as his, he used stand your ground as his reasoning and was able to get off. And, you know, you're saying that perceptions don't have any merit on it. However, in schools under, you know, the zero tolerance policies and the code of conduct, they cite, you know, anything as much as raising your voice or flicking off someone, you know, or having an aggressive demeanor as a reason to feel danger or feel threatened. And so that tied directly into stand your ground and where that boy was able to use that, you know, as a justification for beating this young lady. Another case in Florida where stand your ground didn't work because it doesn't work, you know, and it doesn't work out better for black people is Marissa Alexander. You know, the Dream Defenders were there for her sentencing last summer or last year, where she was not able to use stand your ground against her ex-husband who had, you know, attacked her before, beat her. She had a restraining order against him. And so she shot a gun at the ceiling to scare him off. And it is now in jail for 20 years, you know, not able to see her children grow up. And so for people who say that blacks are disproportionate or blacks are able to use stand your ground, you know, more so than whites, it's just wrong. You know, you can, because whites are using stand your ground and getting off against, you know, their attacks on black people, but black people aren't allowed to use stand your ground in the same manner against, you know, if they use it in defense of or defending themselves from a white person. So,
John, let me ask you this question. And I don't know who was just saying Mark.
That was Horace.
Okay, but let me just ask John this question and then come after you, Horace. I mean, one of the things you wrote in one of your articles, in one of the pieces you wrote, John Nichols, was you have a quote from, I believe, the attorney defending, one of the attorneys defending Zimmerman, who said, as he talked to the jury, he had no, before they went in to make a decision, he had no duty to retreat and had the right to stand his ground and meet force with force, including deadly force, if he reasonably believed that it was necessary to do so. And a key juror had told CNN, as you reported, that she reached not guilty in part because the heat of the moment and stand your ground. John Nichols.
Yeah, actually, what you read there, the first part of what you read there was from the jury instruction, the official jury instruction.
Right, I'm sorry, correct.
Right. And it's very, very important because jurors, I don't know if everybody on the call or, frankly, listeners have been on juries. I have been, or at least been, you know, in the jury pool. And there's a fascinating thing that happens when you're on a jury. You sort of, you go into the bubble. You become a part of that case. You're told to dispense with a lot of your, ideally, to dispense with a lot of your attitudes and ideologies and to really, you know, submit to the moment there, listen to the rules, listen to the testimony, and listen to the instructions. Follow the instructions. And the fact of the matter is, the jury instructions in this case, and the Miami Herald has written extensively about this, one of the leading Florida papers saying there's simply no question stand your ground was a major part of the case. But the jury instructions in the case were specific on stand your ground, read elements of the law into that instruction, and made it very, very clear that that was a part of the decision-making process. For people to suggest now, in this fantasy, that stand your ground wasn't a factor in this case, is simply false. And it's something that is not accepted by people that are looking at the case seriously. But I do think it's important for this discussion to go beyond this high-profile case
mm-hmm.
and to recognize that we have laws on the states, or on the books in states across this country, that were not demanded by the people. Laws that were put there, often very quickly, in a very bureaucratic process, by national groups coming in, working with local legislators, in states that want to keep their stand your ground law. I happen to think these laws should be off the books. I'm not comfortable with them. But in states that want to keep these laws, at the very least, they need to be dramatically better defined so that we don't have these gray area situations where people are debating whether they're a factor or whether they're not, where they're slipping into the jury instructions even when somebody doesn't mount a defense based on them. The fact of the matter is the stand your ground laws in this country are very, very badly written. They're intentionally badly written so that they can be interpreted broadly. And so even in states that keep them on the books, at the very least, people who believe in these principles ought to go back and revisit them and draw them in a much, much more responsible and, frankly, much narrower way.
Horace, you were about to say what in response to that?
I want to apologize a little bit because the audio is somewhat difficult today. But two things. One is there's a bit of a dog chasing after a cudgel issue associated with this stand your ground topic, with it being almost completely unrelated to what happened in the Trayvon Martin trial. We are learning some things about stand your ground. We're learning some things about self-defense that I think would be very, very useful to help us set aside the cudgel. For one, I appreciate all of the advocacy that's taking place in Florida. However, I want to challenge wholeheartedly if what I just heard described was the rationale behind this, there is a host of misunderstandings. There's an asymmetry in civil law and criminal law and a whole host of efforts when you talk about the reasonable man test. Whether it's a car accident, whether it's small claims court, any number of charges allow for this so-called reasonable man test in which varying interpretations about the facts can occur different from that which the individual has at the time where a given incident is occurring. If the reasonable man test is somehow unusual, it calls us to question the whole concept of our civil and criminal law. So that's one reason. The second point is the data that was just described about use and benefit is significantly distorted by this reality. It's a sad, unfortunate fact that there is nearly an 8 to 10 times more likelihood of black youth criminal endeavors over white or Asian or other young people who are engaging in crime. And so you can't simply say, let's just take all of the times that a black is involved in a criminal case, compare it with the number of times that a white is involved, and then argue somehow that there is this disparity that's occurring unless you account for the fact that there is a significantly larger number of crime being committed by one particular demographic. And finally, when you look at the applications of the Stand Your Ground law generally, as I say, this is still third-party review. Even in a case where you think it's completely and totally unjustified, it's because a third party could be a grand jury, it could be a jury itself, could be a prosecutor, assesses whether or not what they saw occur and what you account, it meets that independent test of what a reasonable person would think.
Okay, so
there's plenty of check and balances here. That's all I was trying to get at.
Yeah, and I think people get challenged whether there really are checks and balances here with stand your ground in the states and why certain states have done it and why others have not done it and where it's been done and why. We did contact Alec, and Alec now says they're no longer for stand your ground and they didn't want to come on the program. They sent us a statement, which I can read. But, Danielle, let me get your thought on this before we walk to break.
Honestly, I still go back to perception. And when you're asking someone whether they perceive their life is imminently in danger, and in case of standing ground where you've used deadly force, you really only have one side of the story to say that they thought that they were in imminent danger. There was an incident when I was in New York City once where a man grabbed me in Times Square and tried to drag me off. And because I know a little bit about self-defense, I was able to move my wrist so I could get him to let go of my wrist.
pushed him off me and told me I wanted to be left alone. The man followed me. I went and hid in the CVS for 15 minutes and waited for him to go away until I went and walked on about my business going to a hotel room. And that's a reality that a lot of women live with. Now, I chose to retreat. I sit there and wonder, like, even though I don't feel like this man had any right to invade my space, I don't feel like he had the right to try to drag me anywhere, no matter how attractive he thought I was in that particular moment. I don't know if deadly force is always necessary, even though I felt very threatened in that moment. I was very fearful, you know, for my life and my safety. But I would not have used deadly force because I still value the sanctity of human life. Using deadly force is a last result when you have no other option. And the fact that we make it so easy where you can use deadly force as an option is terrifying to me.
Well, we have to take a very brief break. We're going to come right back and conclude our conversation. And I really want to explore why these bills, why these laws have been passed and where they've been passed. And there are some people who would argue, as Tom Hartman did in one of his articles, that there is a racial component to why these laws are being passed. We'll be right back. Welcome back. We're here with John Nichols, Washington correspondent for The Nation magazine, and Horace Cooper, writer, research fellow at the National Center for Public Policy Research, Daniel Belton, who's editor-at-large for Clutch magazine, and Jacob Sullum, who is a senior editor at Reason magazine, and Sierra, who is with the Dream Defenders in Miami, in Florida. 410-319-8888 is the number here. Comes to this call. It's coming in just a second. But I just want to go back to the beginning here for a moment about what, John Nichols, and you've written about this first, that's why I want you to take first stab at it. Which has to do with the real origin of these laws, not just the origin of these laws, but what they stand for. I mean, we know that, you know, the Second Amendment, in many ways, people would argue the Second Amendment, the original, when you look at the background information for our constitutional conventions, that much of the Second Amendment had to come from the South, one to keep patrols going, to keep slaves in line, and then it was used again during Reconstruction to make sure that black farmers recently freed were able to have guns in their farms. But then the shift took place also historically. But a lot of people are arguing that this law has an element of race and racism to it that was pushed by an industry wanting to sell more guns. I think we don't really get to the root of these things because we're afraid to put them on the table.
Well, I think that the important thing to understand about standing ground laws is something that you referenced right toward the close of that question, which is industries wanting to sell more guns. And there's an element of this that does not get discussed enough, and that is the fact that there are people who make a lot of money selling a lot of guns, and gun manufacturers, but also retailers. And when we took a look at the American Legislative Exchange Council and its efforts to pass these laws, what we're fascinated by was the involvement on the key committees, not of the folks you'd expect, but of big retailers, big folks like Walmart and others, and this is in the past. Many of these groups have now quit, Alec. And you ask yourself, well, why would they want a stand-your-ground law? What would the appeal of a stand-your-ground law? Are they really concerned about, you know, folks defending themselves? Is that a big priority of retailers? And then you realize, no, it's not. I mean, they certainly aren't against it, but that's not central to their business plan. What is central to their business plan is making money. And stand-your-ground laws, because they do allow for someone who has shot someone else to avoid being charged in the case, and close down a lot of legal wrangling, and particularly the potential for lawsuits, potential for initiatives that might bring businesses into the process. And so there's been a lot of effort over the last decade by corporations to pass laws that, you know, on the surface may look like they have a role in the day-to-day life of citizens, but are really about avoiding liability, about making it easier for them to do business, and frankly about making it easier for them to make money. And I think that's a component of this that ought not be lost. And again, I go back to this. When we look back at the passage of these stand-your-ground laws, what we found is that in the periods before they were passed, in state after state, there was no public outcry. There weren't people rising up and marching on the Capitol. There weren't certainly people like the defenders, you know, occupying the Capitol, sweeping in at the Capitol, demanding stand your ground laws. That just wasn't there. This is a manufactured set of legislation imposed on states with insufficient debate. And again, I would say to those states that want to keep these laws, at the very least, they ought to revisit them and bring the citizens of their states into the process, not distant groups like ALEC and not distant corporations that want to make money.
So, and Jacob, so what? Give me the argument against that from your perspective.
Well, I mean, I think there's a legitimate debate to be had about whether this principle makes sense, whether there ought to be a duty to retreat for people attacked in public places. But I don't think the alleged motives of the people passing these laws has anything to do with whether it's good policy or not. I mean, you should recognize that a number of states before this latest wave of laws already had this principle. Illinois, for example, has never had a duty to retreat. Even in New York State, if you are trying to prevent certain kinds of felonies, you do not have a duty to retreat. So I think Danielle earlier mentioned, I couldn't quite make out the story because of the audio, but I think she mentioned being accosted by a man.
Right.
Had she been in fear that he was about to rape her, under New York State law, she would have had a right to stand her ground. It doesn't mean she has to, but it means that she doesn't have to take the risk of turning her back on him and fleeing. That's even under New York law. And speaking of which, even though the stand your ground language is included in the jury instructions in the Zimmerman case, that's part of the standard jury instruction. It doesn't mean it was relevant to the verdict. And in fact, you could have used exactly the same defense in any state and prevailed with that defense because it was a classic self-defense case that he made. So I think if we're trying to figure out, is this a good kind of law to have, we need to get to the specifics of the law and ask, how does it actually affect the outcomes of cases? And are we comfortable with those outcomes? Are these bad outcomes? Are these unjust outcomes? And if so, is it because of something that was changed in the law or not? I mean, these are the kinds of questions we should be asking as opposed to whether, you know, the NRA or the gun industry pushed the law so they can make money. That's not really relevant to the question of whether this is good policy.
Okay, it's relevant if certain organizations push things because they have the wealth and power to do so, whether they're in our interest or not.
Well, it's possibly explanatory if you assume it's a terrible policy and why on earth would we have it, then there's an explanation. But I don't think we should assume that. I think we should investigate it. By the way, the Marissa Alexander case, which someone mentioned earlier, what happened there is I think even under Florida law, prior to 2005, she should have had a right to stand ground. She was in a home that she shared with her husband until recently. And there's actually a Supreme Court decision in Florida that says that a woman who faces an abusive husband does not have a duty to retreat. But what happened in that case is that she had a pretrial hearing where the judge essentially indirectly imposed a duty to retreat by saying she could have gotten out of the house, but she didn't, and therefore I don't really believe she was afraid. So it was indirectly. She was using the fact that Marissa Alexander did not leave the house as evidence that her fear was not reasonable. So that to me is questionable. It seems to me that basically amounts to imposing a duty to retreat. And by the way, the sentence she got was outrageous, and this is because of Florida's absurdly draconian mandatory minimum laws. 20 years, even if you accept the idea that she was not justified, which I'm not sure that she was not justified, it seems to me she was, even if you think it was not justified to fire that gun, 20 years for that seems utterly absurd.
Sierra, tell us, and you're in a state now where all the polls indicate that the majority of Floridians won't stand your ground. So how are you approaching this, and so what is your take on that?
Well, I mean, we're coming at it from several different angles, and I don't think that majority of Floridians want stand your ground. I think that Governor Scott would have many believe that that's the case, but I don't actually think that is the case. And the way that we're looking at it is we're looking at it from a viewpoint of, I guess, sort of how the woman was talking earlier about perceptions and how they're used in a lot of stand your ground cases, people perceiving that there's a fear there. And we like to talk about that in the framework of what we call the criminalization of our youth. And that comes from, you know, the legislation and the racial profiling involved in law enforcement that basically makes it so that people view young people, mainly black and brown young people, as threats, as criminals. And so that's why we're not just here for Stand Your Ground, but we're also here to stop, you know, the school to prison pipeline. We're here to repeal zero tolerance policies that are arresting kids and taking them out of schools and putting them into jails. We're here to discourage legislation that would easily put children into the criminal justice system, because we feel like that's a part of why, you know, a threat was perceived in the first place.
Mark, it's Horace here.
Okay, Horace.
I hear these statements. One, it is a fact that Floridians support the Stand Your Ground law, not a perception, not a misreading by the governor. And in fact, some of the recent surveys show only a slight differential between black Floridians and white Floridians on the subject. Two, it is a fact that the U.S. Department of Justice issues the data on an annual basis that young black and brown youth are disproportionately responsible for the crime that happens in the community, and that data fact doesn't go unnoticed by people when they encounter them. We in the black community might be well served by having a discussion about what's going on that allows young youth to go untrained, undirected, in a way that creates this lingering impression. It seems to me that if we're going to focus on this from a racial issue, we ought to talk about what the data actually says. What the data actually says is that there have been an increase from about 12 a year prior to 2005 in these shooting deaths to about 35 a year. In just Miami alone, the Department of Justice announced this week and a police unjustified shooting investigation in which they believe 8 or 9 blacks were killed as a result of this. Just one town alone. If we were serious about the problem that plagues our community, I think we would put more time and energy into the excessive police use and abuse rather than saying to ordinary citizens, they're the problems and they're the threat that face our community.
So I have to get closing thoughts here from the folks we haven't heard from before we have to go into our next subject on what's happening with the NSA. Danielle, let me get some thoughts from you, then back to Sierra, and then...
I would say that I still really worry about this tendency that the law kind of encourages me to shoot first and to ask questions later. That's really my main fear with this, is that you have people who will just take the law into their own hands. I mean, we have a legal system, we have a justice system, we have a police force, and these are things that make us separate from an uncivilized society. I feel like these laws make us less civilized.
Sierra? Did we lose Sierra?
Yes, I'm here. Sorry, I was having trouble hearing. There's a lot going on in the Capitol right now. I mean, I guess I just have to echo that, and I think that we really need to look further. We need to look further into the disparities within our youth and looking into the criminalization of our young people. I don't agree with statements that were made about young people disproportionately committing crimes in Florida, nor do I agree with, you know, the poll that that people are referencing in terms of, you know, who is in favor of standard down, because I don't think that that poll is accurate. So I think that's something that we need to look further into.
Sierra, not me. You're Sierra Taylor, who's with Dream Defenders. I have your last name right? Right.
Yes.
Well, I want to thank you for your work and for joining us today. And by the way, you can see what Dream Defenders are doing by going to their Facebook page, Dream Defenders, and all the information is there. And we'll be connecting that on our website so you can see it. We'll be connecting all of John Nichols' work on our website as well. And John Nichols, once again, thank you so much for being part of the show.
Terrific. Thank you.
Always a pleasure. Horace Cooper, glad
thank
to have you.
You
back with us. Danielle Belton, thanks for the stuff you're writing. Appreciate you being part of the show as well.
Thank you.
And Jason Solomon, good to have you with us from Reason Magazine. Look forward to having you back.
Thanks a lot.
And we're going to take a very brief break, and we're going to look at the vote in Congress, National Security Agency, and the debate around that. Stay with us.